Good afternoon and welcome to Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Today we join a much larger discussion happening nationally about refugees and the American people. This is one of those issues that seems to raise fervent opinions in nearly every person who encounters the story, but very few have a grasp of the reality of refugee resettlement in this country. Our goal today is to help explain how all this works so that you have better context to understand current events, such as President Donald Trump's executive order issued last Friday. We will talk about that executive order, but we'll also talk about that broader picture I mentioned a few moments ago with three guests who know a lot more about it than I do. Joining us from a special studio in Nashville, Holly Johnson, the state refugee coordinator for the Tennessee Office for Refugees. Holly, hello. I'm sorry. Holly, hello one more time.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing fine. We had to get your mic on there. And joining her in that same studio, Stephanie Teatro, the co-executive director of the Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition. Stephanie, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. And here in the studio with me is Kent Southworth. He's an eligibility caseworker and a Wilson Fish coordinator with Bridge Refugee Services in Knoxville. Kent, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Doggone it, I turned your mic off too. I'm sorry, Kent.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. Thank you for putting up with our technical limitations today. We'll try to get those straightened out in short order here. And of course, I want to begin with the executive order because that's what's in the news right now. It has been for the greater part of the past week. And it's probably the most familiarity that the average person has, hearing about this and the saturation coverage we're getting online in cable news and all the opinions that we've been hearing. So it's an easy springboard for us to get into our larger discussion. Let's talk a little bit about what is actually in it. And according to CNN, for instance, the executive order affects people from seven nations. It bans entry of people fleeing from Syria indefinitely, the admission of all refugees to the U.S. for a 120-day period. That's roughly 4 months. It has 11 sections, some of which are pretty legalese and some of which have been quite inflammatory for both supporters and critics and White House administration officials. And Holly, since you're the point person for the statewide effort, how have you been looking at this executive order? How did you interpret it when it came down and in the days since then?
Stephanie is an expert on, they've got attorneys and people looking at the executive order, and I think she's better equipped to talk about the details of it. But I can tell you from our end, we haven't heard anything from our federal partners yet, so we don't yet know exactly how this will affect resettlement in the state of Tennessee.
All right. Stephanie, how have you been looking at it?
Yeah, so I think it's important to distinguish that in the executive order, a good portion of it does deal with the refugee resettlement program that we've been talking or that we will be talking about. But the seven countries that you mentioned that have been targeted, that's actually about all immigration and not folks who come through the very specific and stringent refugee resettlement program. So they affect two different kinds of travelers. But first, to talk about the refugee resettlement program, this executive order intends to make both long-term changes and then, of course, the short-term impact, which we've seen a lot about in the news. But essentially, the executive order states its intent to pretty radically restructure our refugee resettlement program, which has been in place since the 1970s and has been an important tool of international diplomacy, as well as a statement, you know, an expression of our highest values as the country. So long term, they've clearly expressed their intention to make the program much more difficult for people to be accepted into and resettled into this country, despite the fact that America already has the strictest vetting program of any refugee resettlement program in the world. But additionally, they expressed their intent to introduce religious preference into our resettlement program by clearly stating that refugees fleeing persecution because they are religious minorities would be given preference. And in our current refugee crisis that is clearly referring to Christians from the Middle East. But the short-term impact, and that's what we've seen the most on the news, is that the executive order brought the entire refugee resettlement program to a grinding halt. No refugees will be resettled in the United States for 4 months, for 120 days. That's refugees from all over the world. We're in the middle of a global refugee crisis. There's 65 million people displaced right now, and none of them will be able to be resettled into the country, even those that already had plane tickets, even those that already had apartments or homes or family members waiting for them here. That will be entirely shut down for 4 months. Syrians, like you said, the Syrian resettlement is halted indefinitely. But the president also stated that even once the program is back up and running, that we'll limit the number that we resettle to only an additional 20,000 refugees this year, for a total of 50,000 in this fiscal year. And that is the lowest number America will have ever accepted in our program's history.
Yeah. I want to jump off that for just a moment to talk about those numbers, because I think one of the primary points of opposition, maybe for people who are opposed to the refugee resettlement in general, or state lawmakers here in Tennessee who have said they don't have enough information from the federal government, is there's a perception that this is a huge group of people numbering in the tens of thousands, but actually seem to represent a very small percentage of people coming into the United States, or a small percentage of the states in which they reside. Maybe we could talk, Holly, a little bit about some of the specific numbers. How many refugees have settled in Tennessee in recent years?
Sure. So to give some perspective, like Stephanie said, there's about 65 million refugees worldwide. And most recently, there's been about 80,000 resettled in the U.S. 2% of those are resettled in Tennessee. So on average, it's about 1,400 to 1,600 per year. So this is, you know, about the amount of people that show up at a football game on a Friday night. This is not a huge number, like you may have heard. And that's statewide.
Statewide. Kent, let's bring you into the conversation here, because you work with these refugees when they're coming into Tennessee, and a little bit about how this process works. For instance, how is it determined that a particular refugee or a family or an individual is sent to Tennessee as opposed to somewhere else?
Well, that all happens way above our mm-hmm. level. We in Tennessee, we our local affiliates, like Bridge, we generally don't. We decide whether or not we can help a particular family, but the agencies, the national level resettlement agencies, they decide which families are designated for which final destinations. So they look at, for instance, what ethnic and religious communities exist already in those cities like Knoxville.
Mm-hmm.
They look at what community resources are available, what job markets are like, what housing markets are like. And then they decide, you know, they look at a family and they think, well, this looks like a family that might be able to settle successfully and be self-sufficient in a city like Knoxville. And they essentially run that past us so that we can assure that that family would be able to be to live successfully here.
Okay. We'll get more into that a little bit later on in this hour and kind of pick it up from there, but I wanted to kind of introduce, as we're building the background of this story, a little bit into that. I want to go back to the executive order for just a moment, and maybe then back to Stephanie for this, because you have a good grasp on the legal side of it. The president, ex officio, has broad authority to bar certain people or even groups of people from entering the U.S. That's not a new power. It actually goes back to the Truman administration, a law that was passed in 1952. What is different about this executive order that sets it apart from previous either executive orders or federal statutes that govern immigration and refugee status?
I think there's a few things that make it different and pretty incredibly alarming. One is just how broad it is, right? It's again, banning refugees from every single country where people are fleeing violence and persecution and war. And so the fact that it affects such a broad number of countries is new. Another piece that I think is new is, again, the insertion of religious discrimination, really, into our immigration decisions. And so we know that this is essentially not through the refugee resettlement piece specifically, but the parts of the executive order that bar any travelers from certain countries is essentially a backdoor Muslim ban that the president had campaigned on for so long. But the third way that I think this is incredibly different, too, is just how incredibly reckless the implementation was and how immediate it went into effect. And so, of course, people have seen on the news stories of people who had arrived at the airport and were detained for many, many, many hours. We're working very closely with a family who is currently in Iraq. They were not coming through the refugee, well, they were coming through the resettlement program as a special immigrant with a special immigrant visa. Fuad and his family, they had contracted with the U.S. government as translators in Iraq. They applied for a visa in 2014. After 2 years of extensive vetting, they were approved finally to come to America where they could be safe. They were put in danger for working with the U.S. military. They sold their home. They sold all their possessions. They quit their jobs. They boarded a plane in Iraq on Friday. They landed in Egypt for their transfer flight here to America, and they were turned around. And that is completely un-American. It's not fulfilling our promise to those who are helping our military. And so I think the implementation of this has it's been incredibly jarring, and many of our members of Congress have commented on that already.
One of which was Lamar Alexander, who issued a statement on Sunday evening that made the case that banning immigrants or refugees on religious grounds run counter to what he describes as our American character. So I do want to make sure we get that reaction in there as well. But then Tennessee's junior senator, Bob Corker, skipped that moral question and said it was a matter of safety and security. This is what we've been hearing from the backers of the executive order. In fact, I counted at least three references to the September 11th attacks in the executive order itself. So this was predicated on the idea that there is something intrinsically dangerous about certain refugees from certain countries or of certain faiths coming into the United States. And I would imagine, Stephanie, that you probably disagree with that positioning.
Yes, of course. And we know that, you know, there are many people listening and many people in Tennessee who do have concerns about national security and what is happening in the world. And those fears and anxiety, of course, are valid. But we need to expect more from our elected officials in taking measures to keep our communities safe. And no, this executive order will not do that. Refugees are the most vetted travelers. The facts simply do not support that refugees pose any more significant danger, in fact, much less threat than any other traveler to this country. But also, you know, despite the many references to September 11th in this order, where the hijackers came from, those countries are not listed in this order. So it really is smoke and mirrors and really underestimates, I think, the American people who know that this executive order is not meant to keep them safe, but in fact will likely make us all less safe.
We'll open up the phone lines here in about 3 or 4 minutes if you want to join us with your question at 974-5500. You can also tweet your questions at WUOTFM, all one word, or go to facebook.com/WUOTFM and send us a message there as well to ask your questions on Dialogue. We'll be back with our panel. More talk about the broader picture of refugee resettlement in Tennessee after this station break. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. Welcome back to Dialogue at 20 minutes after the hour, and I misspoke as we headed into the break. The phone number is actually 974-5050, not 5500. That's our pledge drive number. You've got a couple more months before you need to worry about that. 5050 is the number to reach us here on Dialogue and ask a question about refugee resettlement in Tennessee. That's what we're talking about this hour, and our guests include Holly Johnson, State Refugee Coordinator for the Tennessee Office for Refugees, Stephanie Teatro, the co-executive director of the Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition, and Kent Southworth, who's an eligibility caseworker and a Wilson Fish coordinator with Bridge Refugee Services here in Knoxville. And I wanted to ask one more question about the executive order before we branch into a broader part of our discussion. Holly, you alluded to this a little bit earlier. My question was basically, how are your organizations dealing with the effects of this executive order? How is it affecting how you work? And you said a little earlier, Holly, there's just a lot of uncertainty around this. You're waiting for some guidance on the federal level.
That's right. I think that we've all been holding our breath for almost a week now. The refugees that were en route, a few of them are being allowed to travel. I mean, we're talking maybe five families across the state will arrive by tomorrow, and that'll be the last day before the 120 days moratorium begins. Resettlement agencies are sort of scrambling to figure out what this means for them, for their staff, for refugees that are currently here and are nervous. They're scared. Our office, we're trying to put some positivity into it and say, okay, let's look forward. What can we do during this break to help staff remain and keep people positive? But without a lot of guidance from the federal level, we are, you know, sort of left with nothing right now.
Stephanie, you've been watching the legal side of this. I understand that some judges have ruled against provisions, have tried to, issue some decisions on this to offer some clarity or block certain parts of the executive order. What effect has that had?
Yeah, I mean, there was very quick legal action, and we expect much more. I think that's a result of how clumsily this executive order was written and implemented. But Friday night, a federal judge ruled that that they could not detain people in the airports for people who had already arrived on U.S. soil with valid visas, that they could not be detained and deported. They've also now stated that green card holders who live in the United States who are from those seven countries are actually going to be admitted back into the country. And now we're also hearing that they may lift the ban on special immigrant visas. Again, people who help the U.S. government will be able to arrive. And so we expect more legal challenges. We're going to continue to put the pressure on the president and our members of Congress to really overturn not just pieces of this executive order, but the entire thing.
And Kent, what about over at Bridge? How are you guys looking at this executive order? How's it affecting the way you do your jobs?
Well, we're looking at ways that we can, one, gather resources and do fundraising so that we can ensure that that our doors stay open even after this 120-day moratorium ends, because, for one, our funding is very closely tied to the number of people who arrive as refugees in Knoxville. So we're given money to help those people as they arrive. And on top of that, because of the way the screening process for refugees works, a 120-day moratorium doesn't necessarily mean that on the 121st day, refugees start arriving.
Right, it goes back to the way it was before, right.
There are these long series of security checks and medical checks that often most of them have like 180-day, I think, validity. And so, you know, there are people who, you know, were scheduled to arrive in February very likely, you know, their background check will expire during that 120-day moratorium, so they will have to have
they're going to take a step
again.
Back, yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And so it could delay people who were already entirely through the process and ready to come, plane tickets in hand, could be delayed well beyond that 120 days.
Okay, I think that brings up an important point. This is Stephanie jumping in that. This order doesn't just affect new refugees. This isn't people that have not yet arrived. But many of the refugees who are in the pipeline, who, like Ken said, are now halted, and for Syrians, halted indefinitely, many of them have family members who are already here. And so in addition to worrying about the many people who are waiting to seek safety and arrive here, many recently resettled refugees have just been told that their brothers, sisters, parents, children do not have hope of being reunited with them for the foreseeable future. So it's devastating, not just to people abroad, but also here at home.
We're going to turn to the phone lines. Debbie, out on the western periphery of the Cumberland Plateau in Monterey, go ahead with your question for Dialogue.
Thank you for having me. I, listening to the dialogue here and the discussion on the news, it's just permeating everything. For those of us who are incredibly frustrated about the anti-American sense of this order, this ban, how do we, as just an average citizen, let our voice be heard? How can we make a difference in our community to let folks know that most of what they're hearing is rhetoric, and you know, there are people who truly need our help. I feel helpless as I listen to it. What can we do to make a difference?
Stephanie, you spoke to this a little bit earlier in the hour. Do you want to kind of revisit that a little bit?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things that listeners can do, and I really appreciate that question because, again, this isn't just an executive order that affects immigrants and refugees and their families, but really all of us who have a stake and care about American values. So you mentioned in Monterey and wanting to have conversations with, I think, having conversations with your neighbors, people you go to church with. And I know our organization has some tools as well as can point you to the direction of many organizations that can give you some facts and answers to some of those questions you might be getting. But I think the most immediate thing to do is we're really asking people to call their members of Congress, right? We have a set of checks and balances in this country, and we firmly believe that the president has overreached here, and now it's up to the legislative branch, Congress, to rein that back in. And so, we're particularly focused on making sure that Senators Corker and Alexander hear from their constituents, but also your representative in the House to hear from you as well. And we're specifically asking them to intervene in the case of Fuad Sharif, which I mentioned. So on our website and on our social media pages, you can find a link to ask the senators to bring Fuad and his family for their service to the U.S. military to Tennessee immediately. And then tonight, actually, in 10 cities across the state, including in Knoxville, Johnson City, Chattanooga, we're hosting vigils. We're expecting thousands of Tennesseans to join us, and so you can go on our website and see if there is one near you.
Okay, Debbie, thank you for that question. Similar question from Scott on Twitter, and this one I'll direct to you, Kent, because he's asking what can people in Knoxville or East Tennessee do to help bridge. But with all the uncertainty around, is there anything much people can do for you directly?
Absolutely, yes. Oh. So we are now in a very uncertain funding situation. So if people are able to donate, that would be very, very helpful. We still have around 400 clients who have arrived in the last year in East Tennessee, and many of them still need help, guidance, assistance in various ways. So if people are interested or if they can't donate, they can contact us to volunteer.
Oh, okay. And we've got Melinda on the phone in Knoxville with, I believe, Melinda, you're going to ask a question that I wanted to ask. Go right ahead.
Well, I was hearing from you and elsewhere about the very stringent vetting of potential immigrants. But in a place like Syria, where everything is torn apart, there would be no access to records or anything that would allow you to vet a Syrian refugee. So how do you vet a Syrian refugee?
Yeah. Okay. So who wants to take this one? I'm not sure who might be more adept at this question.
I'll take it. This is Holly.
Hey, Holly. Go right ahead.
Thank you. Great question. And I had thought the same thing, that maybe Syrians didn't have a lot of paperwork. First of all, the folks that determine refugee status for individuals who have applied for that status are used to working in situations where those applicants don't have documentation. They don't flee in the middle of the night and remember to stop by the school and get a school record or birth certificate. They are able to get around a lot of that by when the individual shares their story and they say, well, I was affected by this incident that happened in my village. The screener knows from historical and anecdotal information whether there was an attack in that village. So that's, for example, one thing. But regarding Syrians in particular, they actually do have a lot of paperwork. When you come from a country where the regime is so interested in keeping track of its people, they make sure that everyone has documentation at all times. And despite what we've heard, Syrians do have a lot of documentation to prove who they are.
Well, this gets me to an interesting point, and I want to get into this too, because in common reportage, the term refugee has come to mean a specific kind of refugee. That is, people from the Middle East, more specifically Syria, that we hear from, debated about so often at the national level. But refugees really come from all over the place. It has less to do with geography or nationality than it does with the situation. What is it that defines a refugee?
A refugee is someone who has a well-founded fear of persecution based on their race, their religion, their nationality, their political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. Refugees are not undocumented. They don't cross borders into the U.S. They don't come on fiancé, student, or visitor visas. They're not victim of natural disasters. They're not looking for better economic opportunities for their families. They have no choice but to leave their country, or they will be persecuted, tortured, raped, killed, imprisoned because of who they are.
Kent, because you're an eligibility caseworker who works with refugees, I imagine there's no such thing as a typical story that you hear, but what are some of the common threads about the people that you work with who have come here to the United States?
The thing that always strikes me is just the fundamental kind of normalness of everyone that we work with. Mm-hmm. You know, like, they're just average people who will chat with you, laugh with you. They get bored, they get tired, and, you know, they're
human
just
beings,
like us.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
We have, in Knoxville, you know, we've had a relatively higher percentage, I think, than some other cities of Iraqi refugees and special immigrants who have worked with the U.S. military, just for whatever demographic reasons, they come to Knoxville more often, I think, than some other places.
Interesting. Okay.
And so, one thing that I have always been struck by is the the level of excitedness about being in America, among a lot of the people that we work with.
Okay, all right. Yeah, so let me ask this too. When one becomes a naturalized citizen, and Stephanie, I think you made this distinction a moment ago, we're not talking about the same groups of people, that a refugee has a specific kind of definition they have to meet, and I imagine a different kind of process to go through. So when one becomes a naturalized citizen, that can be expensive. It could be north of $700 in some cases, and that's assuming everything goes well and you don't have to hire a lawyer or something. Are there fees or anything like that, or money that has to be paid for the processing for incoming refugees?
This is Holly.
Hey,
there. There is not. They do receive a loan for their travel here, and that is a loan. It's not a gift. It's not a grant. It's a great way for refugees to establish credit once they're here in the U.S., which is so important, as we've all discovered. And it's an interest-free loan, and they have a little while until they're working before they have to start making those payments. But that's the only financial obligation of the refugee. They're fleeing in the middle of the night. Often they're not able to stop, or they're not getting any money they wouldn't be able to pay. The only exception to that would be refugees coming from Cuba have had an exit fee that they have to pay to the Cuban government. So it's not about being a refugee, but it's about that country.
Mm, okay. I was going to ask, too, what is the ultimate goal? Like, does somebody stay a refugee, legally speaking, for the rest of their days in the U.S.? Do they eventually become naturalized? What is sort of the end goal for somebody who comes into this country as a refugee?
The end goal is for them to become a citizen of our country. Mm-hmm. What's really fun is when refugees first arrive, they're thankful to be someplace safe. They're sad that they're not able to be in their home, in their own country, but they're thankful to be someplace safe. And they'll say, you know, one day I want to go back to my country. And then about a year later, you talk to them and they said, yeah, I don't want to go back. I'm really happy to be here. I'm looking forward to becoming an American citizen someday. That's a 5-year wait until they're an American citizen. And we refer to refugees often as anyone up until the point where they're a citizen. But really, we should call them refugees for the first few months. And then they're just new Americans. They're part of our community, part of our culture, and just want to be like us.
The other end goal, I think, in addition to sort of citizenship and really becoming part of the community of the Refugee Resettlement Program is self-sufficiency, right? The Refugee Resettlement Program is designed to help people flee tremendous violence, to rebuild their lives in America, and to quickly, I mean, the numbers from the Office of Refugees here in Tennessee are quite impressive about how quickly these families, despite everything they've been through, do reach self-sufficiency and have jobs and end up buying houses, going to school and colleges, entering the workforce, and ultimately applying for citizenship.
There's something that I want to mention that's part of this. This actually comes from a survey that was, or a study, that was commissioned by the Tennessee General Assembly, I think in 2013, and they wanted to find out how much are refugees costing, you know, taxing state services and this and that and the other, and how much they put back into the economy. And the report that came back from the General Assembly, and this was as of 2013, so I'm sure the numbers have changed, was that making conservative estimates, they said that since 1990, so 23 years before, the state spent $753 million on services for refugees. That include education, that includes health care, but received back almost twice as much, $1.3 billion, mainly in the form of tax revenues. So we're talking about people who actually do put something back into the economy and the communities in which they reside. Is that right?
That's right. You know, Tennessee and some of the bigger cities like Nashville and Knoxville have been blessed with population growth over the last several years. And there's sort of unanimous agreement that that kind of population growth is spurring our economy and really helping the entire state. And so the same is true with refugees. When they come to this country, they create jobs, they fill important roles in the labor market. But that's also why in other states, you know, specifically in the Rust Belt in Ohio and Michigan, cities are actually competing for refugees and are asking for refugees to be resettled because they know it will be a boon for their economy. And so, yes, I wish that report that was issued by the state of Tennessee was referred to more often, because the evidence is clear that when refugees are resettled, the important work of resettlement agencies is to help them get on their feet, and then they become contributing members of our community, both economically, civically, and culturally.
All right, we'll pause for another station break. Remember, you can call us with your questions at 974-5050. Or go online. You can tweet us your question at WUOTFM, or, of course, write us on Facebook, facebook.com/WUOTFM. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Dialogue continues from WUOT News.
Support for WUOT comes from UT's Clarence Brown Theater, presenting Outside Mullingar, part of the Shod Company's main stage series. The romantic comedy featuring Carol Mayo Jenkins is set in the rural hills of Ireland. Runs through February 19th. Tickets at clarencebrowntheater.com.
Some regular people, not tech nerds, have found a way to make a really good living on Facebook.
This is the best thing in the universe. I was like, look, I finally found a way to do what I love and get paid for it.
But those jobs are now in jeopardy.
This page has been unpublished. This page has been unpublished. And I was like, oh my God.
I'm Audie Cornish, how it's all falling apart. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in for All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 on WUOT.
Dialogue now continues here on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and in case you're just joining us, our subject today is refugee resettlement in Tennessee, separating fact from fiction. And I'm joined in studio by Kent Southworth, an eligibility caseworker and a Wilson Fish coordinator at Bridge Refugee Services here in Knoxville. And we're joined on a special remote line by Holly Johnson, state refugee coordinator for the Tennessee Office for Refugees, and Stephanie Diatro, the co-executive director of the Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition. As we continue along into this final third of the show, I wanted to bring up something the Tennessee General Assembly has been pursuing for a little while now, a lawsuit that would stop refugee resettlement in the state. Now, the lawsuit contends state officials don't know enough about the vetting process or that the process itself is inadequate in some way, but that's a sentiment we commonly hear in opposition to refugees entering the United States. We don't know enough about them. We don't know enough about what's happening. We need more information. So why don't we spell it out? And I'm not sure who to begin with here. Maybe, Holly, you could give us a broad picture. What is the current process for vetting a refugee from start to finish? And we use that word, vetting. What is it we're talking about?
Sure. So refugees first to become a refugee or receive that status, you must be outside of your country of origin because, again, you're trying to prove that well-founded fear of persecution. So if you're in your country, then clearly you're not feeling that persecution very strongly. The refugee program is the lengthiest and most difficult way to come to the U.S. Refugees can't cross borders. The process takes 18 to 24 months, and there's an in-person interview required for all refugees. The screening process includes a collection of biodata. There's an initial interview just simply to determine if the individual meets the definition of refugee. If so, they are referred to a country. There's 28 countries that resettle refugees. If they're accepted conditionally into the U.S., then they go through our screening process, the United States screening process, which, as Stephanie mentioned, is the most stringent. If they're accepted to Germany, for example, they would go through the German process. Here in the U.S., the file is created, information is collected, the security checks occur. That is in conjunction with Homeland Security, the National Counterterrorism Center, and the intelligence community, the FBI's Terrorist Screening Center, State Department, Department of Defense, and other international agencies. Each refugee is interviewed. There's no exceptions to that. That interview cannot be waived, as it can in other countries' resettlement programs. They collect fingerprints for biometric checks. That's screened against FBI, Homeland Security, and Department of Defense databases. In some countries, they also do iris scans. Syria is one of them. The process can be stopped at any time if anything is found. If there's any sort of new information or intelligence, it results in a redoing of the entire process or a piece of that process. That screening is ongoing. The medical screening that Kent mentioned earlier is performed. Immunizations are provided. And before they arrive in the U.S., they get some additional checks against TSA and Border Patrol. State Department officials were here recently, and one of the things that really struck me, the head of the refugee program there said, in screening refugees, there is black, there is white, and all the gray is black. And to me, there's not a more clear statement than that. It doesn't do anybody any good for us to let in an individual that has any sort of terrorist tie. And, you know, what we try to remind people is that refugees are fighting the same things we are. They're not our enemy. They're on our side.
Mm. All right, Mike, in Knoxville, you've been patient. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, I heard you mentioning about these thousands and millions of dollars that you are doing to help out these people. What about helping out our own people that are in rural Appalachia that could use loans and assistance to get back into the workforce? To do that for them, and I was wondering, why fly these people thousands of miles away to a country that they're not even used to or not even part of the culture, they don't speak the language, when you could be helping out our own people or resettling them in countries that are near them or beside them, like Saudi Arabia or Iran or Iraq, which they are speak the same language and they have the same culture. And I was just wondering what you thought about that aspect.
Mm-hmm. We could turn maybe to Holly. You're our state coordinator here. Just kind of a broad answer to that.
Yeah, this is Stephanie. I might jump in there.
Okay.
And
yeah, sure. Go
that.
Right ahead. Yeah.
We have the pleasure of being able to look at each other and point. I appreciate that question, Mike, and I think it's a good one. And so I think with our as a country and really as the leader of the free world, we have both important domestic responsibilities as well as international. So it's worth noting that America is not the only country that is resettling refugees, and there are neighboring countries as well. But as a leader in the world, it's important that we fulfill our international obligations and duties as well to support people who are, again, are fleeing violence, are fleeing terror. And so the percentage that America takes is quite small compared to many of the countries that are, like you said, nearer to a lot of these conflicts. But it is also true that the Refugee Resettlement Program is a very small part of our federal budget. And I I absolutely agree with you that the federal government should be doing much more to invest in communities domestically, and especially in Appalachia. I think that those two, both, you know, doing our international duties to keep the world safe and keep America safe and provide safe refuge for people fleeing those things, is an important part of our legacy and our country's leadership. And so is taking care of residents who are here and who need that support. So I would argue that I hope we can do both, and that we should be pushing our members of Congress to make both kinds of investments.
I was about to say, it sounded like a false dichotomy to me, because it assumes that helping a refugee comes at the detriment of somebody who's from the United States or lives in this part of the country. And I might also point out that we do have federal, state, and local agencies that are designed, from the Appalachian Regional Commission on the federal level to CARM or Volunteer Ministry Center here in Knoxville on the local level, that are engaged in helping people who may be unemployed or help them get education. Governor Haslam announced some education initiatives to help more adult Tennesseans get, you know, technical college education that might broaden their job opportunities as well. So I agree with you. It seems like the work is happening on both levels. It's not an either-or proposition. And Mike, thank you for bringing that up. That's really cool. Brenda from Knoxville, you're on the line with Dialogue. Go ahead.
Yes, I have a comment and a question also.
Okay.
I've gotten to know a lot of refugees in Knoxville over the last 3 years. I've met over 100. I teach English as a second language, and I've had over 40 in my home for meals, and I've tried to get to know these people as friends. My question is specifically related to the Iraqi refugees. I have known 16 who have gone back to Iraq. And I'm wondering why this is happening, and also what can be done to prevent Iraqi refugees choosing to return back.
Good question.
Yeah.
You were going to say something. Yeah.
I think whenever a person comes to the U.S. as a refugee, fleeing some sort of danger, you know, their lives have all the same complications that ours do, often kind of amped up to a higher level.
Mm-hmm.
I have anecdotally heard of Iraqi refugees who have returned to Iraq, and often the reasons are very personal. Things like relatives in their home country are gravely ill,
yeah,
and they want to be with them in their last days. So I think it's important to maintain compassion for those people, because those decisions can be so difficult. Because, you know, anytime someone comes to the U.S., they are fleeing a legitimate danger. And if they're going back into that danger, they have a very good reason to do that.
Okay. I wanted to continue along. When you communicate with people who are outside of your particular fields, working with refugee resettlement, who maybe don't know as from the inside perspective the way you do, but definitely have some opinions about it, either pro or con, how do you communicate with those folks about the reality of what it is you do? How do you fight the misinformation? And maybe, Stephanie, we could begin with you.
Sure. I mean, I think to the last caller's point, meeting refugees and hearing their stories, to me, is what really breaks down those barriers and makes the question of whether or not America should continue resettling refugees quite simple. And I think we've seen that very powerfully and very clearly with even members of the General Assembly who maybe had supported previously some of these more anti-refugee measures, but once they had the chance to meet their constituents who are former refugees, their minds have changed completely. And I think in Tennessee, most refugees are resettled in the four big cities. And so often a lot of the misconceptions, I think, arise from people not having that sort of proximity. So part of our work is helping refugees to tell their stories. And so, you know, there's been a lot of media stories lately, both locally and nationally, that really allow refugees to tell exactly what they were fleeing, their aspirations for their new home in America, and really what the life-saving work of resettlement is. And there's really no better substitute for that kind of storytelling as an explanation.
Holly, what about you? Yeah, how do you communicate with people who are not familiar with this idea or want to know more?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. I think there is so much misinformation circulating, and that's much louder than the facts. And my husband teases me because when I get calls in my office and someone has questions, I will return every single call and I'll talk to every single person because I think people are one-on-one. They feel heard. They can have their specific questions asked. And frankly, I'm not trying to convince anyone. I just want to give them the facts and then they make their own decision. I mean, that's what makes this country great is we can have different decisions. But I think once someone, like Stephanie said, hears the facts of the resettlement program, who refugees are, they don't choose to come to the U.S. They don't get to select which country they'll come to, and that there's services here for them when they arrive, I think that they make the right decision on their own.
Yeah, and I think that really gets the point of it. It's you know, oftentimes people who are in opposition to the refugee program, it's because they have encountered misinformation or misleading information. And so it is just important to make sure that people you're speaking with have the facts.
But this brings up a point that we, on a previous edition of Dialogue, talked about. This was last December. We talked about civility in post-election conversations. And one of the points that our guests made at that time was that kind of dialogue works only when both parties are willing to have it. If you're doing the work to try to listen, be civil, present facts, but the other party or parties in that conversation are not, how do you work forward from that when somebody is convinced that you're not telling them the truth or that you're not giving them the facts as they think they might exist, Kent? How do you do that?
Well, in my job, I'm largely shielded from that because I work primarily with
the refugees.
And the people I meet out in the community are my friends and family. And so, and when you're speaking with someone face to face, it's kind of a different thing than, for example, talking online
or on social media. Right. Yeah.
And so face to face, I think it is easier because they to maintain that civility just because you know, people are a lot more hesitant to be mean to you, to your face.
Interesting. Well, Holly and Stephanie in Nashville, let me turn that question to you then. How do you deal with people who are not just curious, but really more resistant to what you're trying to tell them?
Well, I think it's a small percentage of people who are, I think, you know, resistant and unwilling to hear the facts. I think there's far more people who have questions, right, and have certain feelings of anxiety, again, about national security or about the economy, like we heard from previous callers. And so the way we try to approach it is, you know, validating those concerns and then really talking about the program or whatever the issue at hand is. I think it's really just unfortunate that, again, a small percentage of people who either are incredibly loud, or in the case of some politicians, incredibly opportunistic, get sort of a larger megaphone. But I would say Tennesseans, by and large, are welcoming, they're hospitable, they are compassionate, and they are generous. And it's a matter of just creating more spaces to have that kind of dialogue.
Yeah, I agree. Tennessee is a welcoming state. And by far, the calls that I get are very supportive, especially in the times when the refugee issue is such a kind of volatile one. We get more and more calls supporting what we do. I think, like Stephanie said, you validate people's concerns. You quote sources for the information that are the facts that you're telling them. And then ultimately, if they choose to believe their neighbor who read something on a blog versus someone who does this every day for a living, there's nothing I can do about that.
Well, as professionals who work in this field, all three of you, I am sure there are things that you'd like to change, and that could mean something that makes the process easier on the federal-state interface, something that makes it more beneficial for refugees or their communities, or something that makes your job easier. And Kent, we can start with you. What is something that you, if you had your druthers, you'd like to change that might make this process move a little smoother?
I guess, so more communication between local affiliates like ours and all the steps along the chain, I think would be nice because, you know, a lot, like, In particular, I periodically help people with paperwork to refer their relatives who might be eligible to become refugees to go through that screening process. And you know, once they file the paperwork, you know, they'll come and talk to me over and over, asking like, "When is my husband coming? When is my husband?" Yeah. And you know, and it's difficult to get that that information. So it would be nice if
there was more like a free flow of information in terms of like how things are in process.
And I don't know how feasible that would be, since it involves, you know, like so many different, you know, not just in the U.S. parts, but UN and overseas components. So,
well, Holly and Stephanie, what about for the two of you? What would you like to change that you think might make this work better?
Well, first of all, I like the screening process that's in place now. I would not advocate for any shortcuts on that, for shortening it, for changing it in any way to make it less stringent. I think what makes the program great is that it's so successful that we've not let a terrorist in through the refugee program. That's really important. But I think if I could change anything, I would like to provide assistance to refugees longer, so that instead of immediately coming in and securing a job, they can spend some time focusing on learning the English language first. Knowing the language and of the country where you live, I think, just helps you become part of that community and feel like you're part of that community and be able to communicate with neighbors and store owners and medical personnel. And that would be the number one thing.
And that gets back to that issue that our caller Mike raised earlier, which was about the cultural assimilation. You're talking about maybe you'd like to see a little bit more emphasis on things that would make that transition a little bit smoother.
Absolutely. Right now, resettlement agencies do comprehensive orientations for all of their newly arrived refugees. And while the topics that are covered and the length of time is really great, that comes at a time when refugees have recently uprooted, I mean, not recently uprooted, but been uprooted from the refugee camp and come to the U.S. and they're completely overwhelmed, trying to just sort of get their feet under them, and then need to absorb all of this new information about this new culture. So, you know, that sort of assimilation piece is also very important. And while it does happen very well through the resettlement agencies, having more time and being able to wait a little bit longer until refugees are settled a little more to do that, I think would be helpful.
And Stephanie, how about for you? What would you like to see change that might make things a little bit better for you?
I think I would love to see more opportunities for U.S.-born Tennesseans to meet their new refugee neighbors. Hmm. I think that we, as a nation, in the midst of a global refugee crisis, when the largest number of people have been displaced since World War II, I think we need to welcome more refugees. I think the number is shamefully low given the crisis and given what we can do as a generous nation. And then the third would be that I think elected officials should not be able to introduce laws about the refugee resettlement program before actually understanding how it works.
Okay, well, on that note, we'll have to close it out for Dialogue today. Thank you to Holly Johnson, Stephanie Teatro, Kent Southworth for being on the program today. Greg Hill is our producer. Special thanks to Chrissy Kuiper. Thanks to Pam Holland and Dave Walton at Spotland Productions in Nashville. They arranged our technical connection. Dialogue is a production of 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth.